This is When Orla Met. Now, I like to introduce this podcast as a conversation with and about some of the leading athletes, fascinating characters, and engaging brains in sport. Well, today's podcast guest falls very squarely into that third category. He's one of the most influential thinkers to have shaped the sporting conversation over the last decade. And indeed, his approach has spread far beyond simply sport to business, politics, any kind of performance, really. And if you've read his theory, it will surely have made you think about how you live, or at the very least, how you see that you can live your life. The man in question is a clinical psychiatrist, Dr. Steve Peters, and his theory is that of chimp management. Now, if you don't know anything about that yet, then get your brain in gear, because this man has worked with the likes of Sir Chris Hoy, Victoria Pendleton, the world champion snooker player Ronnie O'Sullivan, the England football team, Liverpool football team, stars of athletics, swimming, and many more. And those who follow his practices absolutely swear by them. If you've ever wanted to get into what sports people call the zone, or if you've ever wanted to try to manage the worst excesses of your own brain to be happier, more efficient, more at peace, then this is the chat for you. This is When Orla Met, Dr. Steve Peters. Steve, thank you for sitting down with me. I know you're a very busy man. You're best known in sport, I think, for your work with, well, initially British cycling, certainly, but then many teams, the England football team, Liverpool, etc. But you started your professional psychiatry career as a forensic psychiatrist, and before that you were a mathematician, is that right, and a teacher. How did you get interested in the workings of the mind?
I took a degree in maths first. Yeah, I became a teacher. And it was always a decision at school between being a vet and a teacher. But I'm not really a cat lover. So I decided that wasn't a very good idea. So I went into teaching, but then actually thought again and thought actually medicine was probably more in line with what I wanted to do. So I retrained as a doctor a long, long time ago now, and then set off as a doctor intending to start as a GP. I was a bit sidetracked in towards surgery, and then came back full swing and decided to do psychiatry. But I have to confess, at that point, I wasn't really that interested in the human mind as such, because this is going back a long time ago, and we used to do one in twos on call, which means 36 hours on, 12 off, which thankfully is now illegal. And because of that, I wanted a break, and psychiatry was quite low key in the sense it was one in nine on call at the local hospital. So I took the job really for a break, and then come back again. But once I got in, it just was a light bulb moment that, apart from it being a very academic subject where you've got to really understand how the brain and the mind function, it was also probably one of the hardest disciplines, because you didn't have the backup of blood tests and x-rays and scans. It really was you working out what's going on inside the patient's head, and then deciding, is this a real illness, or is it actually just an approach to life that's the problem, or is it a combination of two? So it became a real challenge. So I actually started life as a general adult psychiatrist, and I worked in the NHS for 20 years. So I was working with drugs and alcohol fields. I was working with depressive illnesses and so on. And then towards the end of my career, I moved into forensics, and then really was specialising in personality disorders. And while I was doing that in the NHS, I was also academically working at Sheffield Medical School, and I'm still there, as a senior clinical lecturer. So I was teaching medicine, and that was then becoming like very specialised into teaching around the human mind and how it functions or doesn't function, and what we can do to get quality of life and optimise performance. So I ended up specialising in the neuroscience of the mind, and that led me into eventually towards sport.
And the forensic part of your psychiatry, we're talking about dealing with serious, dangerous personality disorders, and I guess in many cases as well with, for you, dangerous criminals. I mean, I guess there are very few parts of the human mind that are so dark that you haven't seen them.
Yeah, I mean, it is probably what most people would colloquially say is gruesome work, but I never actually saw it that way, because what you're really doing is looking at people that are defined under the Mental Health Act as being mentally ill. And even psychiatrists debate this, whether psychopathic individuals are actually ill or just built that way, in which case it's not an illness. But they come under the umbrella of being ill, and they come under the umbrella of the NHS. And so if someone then transgresses the law, then they come under the forensic services. So yes, you're dealing with the very sharp end. And there are levels of forensic work. So you can get like closed wards in a general adult setting in any hospital. But then there's levels of risk and dangerousness. You then go to secure units. And then finally you go to what's called the special hospitals. And there are three of those in the UK which cover the catchment between them. And I worked in Rampton.
Were there any experiences there that maybe baffled you? I mean, your whole job is understanding the human mind, and you know, you mentioned quite casually psychopaths. I mean, I guess in the media we tend to demonize even the phrasing of that. But what was your time in Rampton Hospital like?
Well, it was work, and obviously my job was to assess people and see if we could do anything for them. And work with them, or if we felt we could chip away at things or detain them, is to stop the public from being at risk. So it was a lot of legal work, as well as medical work, as well as psychiatric work. So it was a combination of those. I found it interesting. I found it, you know, very good to work there. It was a job. It didn't faze me, the type of work or the type of men that I met and worked with. And I think, very importantly, you mentioned there where we demonise, and I think from my perspective as a doctor, I'm not there to judge people. I'm there to do a job. So what they've done is not as important to me, in the sense of I'm not morally judging. I'm seeing where this person is sitting and where they're going. And I think that's a really critical point as to where we're going in this interview, that my job is never to judge people, and it's never to tell people what to do. And I never have done that. What I ask people to do is explore their own minds and then see what it is they want to do with them. So if people are psychopathic and they say they enjoy killing, for example, or whatever, then my job isn't to condemn that, is to assess it and then explain to them the consequences of that and act accordingly.
Were there any minds that you worked with there that you were unable to unpick or take that process through to its conclusion? You say about explaining the consequences, but I would imagine that if someone does things that most of us in right-minded society believe to be shocking or horrific or beyond comprehension, that might be quite difficult to make them see the conclusion in the same way that other people not suffering or built that way, whichever way you want to look at it, that they would perceive it to be.
The difficulty we get when we start sort of delving into this is, what do we define as normal? Mm-hmm. It only is what most people think is acceptable. So you have to get to a point where you become non-judgmental and you step outside of culture, and you have to say, how is this particular person perceiving the world? So I'm not sure it's about sort of understanding or unpicking a mind as much as it is going with it and assessing information to see and predicting from their beliefs or behaviours, what will they do in the future? That was really what the job is. So if somebody says they enjoy sadistic killing, then clearly there is a serious risk, it's blatantly obvious. And then it's just a case of gathering evidence to go before a court and say, this is why this person needs to be detained. But you're not there to put them on the right track. You're there to explore and see, are you on the right track? So it always is the same with my work, is when we get there with the sport, it's never to tell somebody what to do. It's to ask them, what are you trying to achieve? What are you doing at the moment? And there are alternatives. Do you want to explore alternatives that your mind will work with? And if it works for you, great. But if you feel, no, I know what I'm doing, then I don't have a place. So I'm not necessarily analysing to unpick and redirect. I'm more analysing what they're doing and feeding back to people and saying, what do you want to do with this?
So how did you get from that then, from working with the dangerous criminals? And I know you're involved in the police profiling of the Soho murderer, for example, Ian Huntley. How did you get from that to the seeming leap that it looks like to sport?
I think this was just by accident, really. It was one of the students at Sheffield Medical School took a job with British Cycling as a medical doctor, medical officer, and gave me a call one day and said, do you remember me? And I did, an excellent student. And he said, I'm struggling with a cyclist who I think has got mental illness and I'm not sure what to do. Would you give me opinion? And I'm very happy to do that. So I went and met the cyclist. I can't name people who haven't given me permission, so I can't name the cyclist, and worked with that cyclist. From my perspective, it was a fairly straightforward case because it's my field. So I basically helped the cyclist to reorientate where they wanted to be. And then there wasn't an illness. there was what I call dysfunction, which is where you've got this amazing machine in your head, but you're not quite sure how to run it, so it's running you. And when he did that, he did significantly better. And by sort of chance, then Dave Brailsford saw that and asked, how did this happen? And then asked to meet me. So I met with Dave Brailsford, who was a great guy and very challenging, which I really like. I'm quite happy to be challenged. And he asked me what I did, and I explained, really, I'm a therapeutic doctor and I work in forensic at the moment, and this is what I do, it's my field. I'm a professor at Sheffield. And he then asked me to work with another athlete, which I did. And then it sort of like started to snowball. He liked what I did. He felt it was very evidence-based, which I said, well, at the end of the day, I'm a doctor, I'm a scientist. I expect it to be evidence-based and I expect it to work. And I was introduced to Chris Hoy. So Chris was an amazing guy, absolutely easy to work with, very keen to work, very keen to have insights and understand. And I see people in his position as students, and so he was an excellent student. And he learned skill bases, and then I went undercover to Athens. I said I didn't want to be in the limelight. It wasn't my world. Chris got his gold medal, and then Dave approached me and said, we'd like to work full-time with us, and I rejected the offer because I felt, you know, this is not my field, and I wouldn't say I'm an avid sports fan. I'm an avid people fan, so it doesn't matter what people do. I just like to see people succeed and do well in life. And it took me 12 months, and then even, you know, the boss at Rampton was saying to me, why on earth are you waiting? This is such an opportunity. And I didn't quite see it that way, really. I thought, I spent 30 years or so training up to this point. Why would I now go to a world I know nothing about and start again? But I think something struck me. The more I worked with people like Vicky Pendleton, Chris, I'm very public about this, the more I realise you're actually doing the public a service because the public were behind them. It was bringing a lot of pleasure to a lot of people. And it also struck me that obviously sports people are no different to anybody else. So the more cyclists I met, the more I realised it's the same spectrum. You know, some of them are not well, some of them are just quite dysfunctional, some of them are great players. They're just Joe Public, except they can cycle. So it became, I moved my outpatients from the hospital system into sport and started seeing elite athletes. And that snowballed. So I got this reputation suddenly that is very quirky. There's this forensic psychiatrist who's marched in, and Chris was trying to explain to people what I'd done and why he believed that was a major influence on his medal. And so the teams, Bree Swimming came in next and said, could you please see someone? And so I met the head of swimming and I just said, look, I don't know, this will work. All I can do is offer you what I do. So I asked him to give me two swimmers that were struggling, and I worked with them. And again, they were very driven guys. I can't put talent in. I can't do that. What I can try and do is stop them sabotaging themselves and then therefore unlock the talent. And they both, I was given two great guys. So again, it's a lot of luck, and they did really well. And that was it. Then I just started getting all the sports coming in, saying, please, can you have a look at someone? And it's been a massive privilege to do that.
So tell me about your theory then. I mean, it's become incredibly well known now, the chimp theory. But for anyone listening who hasn't either heard of it or heard you explain it, tell us what it is and how it works.
It all began in the 90s, so it's been around 20 years. I teach the medical students at Sheffield, and teaching the neuroscience of the mind and the way that the structures work and interact with each other and the sort of the rules of the mind is not easy. And they need to know some of the basics, but not in the depth that, you know, I would know it. But when I was doing this, they were fascinated. So what they were doing is saying, can you explain it, but could you make it simpler? And it was very difficult because it is very complex. But when I started really looking at this closely, and this is simplifying it, you do see three...
Please do.
Yeah, you see three systems that are really sort of like fighting, at times come together, but fighting for control of your mind, so that they can operate in the way that they're built to operate. And we've got one system which is very primitive and very powerful. And Freud started this by calling the parts of the limbic areas in the middle of the brain the id. But he didn't have access to scanners like we do, so we now recognise that that's actually connected to a very strong thinking part of our brain, just above our eyes, which means it isn't just primitive, it's actually quite adept at thinking things through. The problem is when it does think, and we see this on functional MRI scans, when it thinks in a very emotional way. It doesn't work with facts and information, it works with emotions and feelings.
So, and this is the chimp part of the brain.
This is the chimp system. So really, I was looking for a word to describe that because that system is very, very similar to in all of the hominids. That's the great apes. So it's slightly different in the lower animals. Where you look at, say, a monkey, you do see a discrepancy in these two. They're not the same brain, whereas the hominid brain is similar across the group. So the gorilla, the orangutan, the chimp, the human, and the bonobo, these are the five that normally get grouped together. Some people add the gibbon onto it. So what you've got is this brain, and if I make it simple and say it's a system, I call it the red system, which is what I started, is a red system. And it's a red alert to say, look, I'm constantly worrying, I'm constantly looking for danger, I'm constantly overreacting because I necessarily have to if you're going to be safe, because this system is what's built for jungle life. Mm-hmm. So it must be excessively cautious. The more cautious, the more chance you have of surviving. So if you think of that, and I'm being a bit extreme, that system needs to be pretty neurotic, because otherwise we won't make it. And it shouldn't have confidence, and it should worry, and it should avoid conflict. Because if we go into conflict and lose, generally speaking, in the jungle, you lose your life.
So actually, when that part of the brain is dominating, we can often these days label that as being neurotic and saying that we're overreacting to things or overthinking things. But actually, that's quite natural, is it?
It's really healthy. It's really healthy. It's not helpful. And there's a difference. So it's very helpful thing to say, if you're going to cross a road that's really busy and the cars are coming, is to be really worried. That's a really good thing to do. It means you're on edge. And if you see a car, hear a car, you don't go. You don't take a risk, because risk taking could lose your life. So that system is necessarily what we probably judgmentally call neurotic. What I'd call it is very vigilant, very overreactive, very low risk, so it's risk aversive. That is the general rule. Now, at this point, I'm going to detour slightly. So I've got this red system, I'll call it. What's important is, which strikes you immediately, it's not the same in everyone. It's a spectrum. So there's lots of research on why this is a spectrum. So it's partly genetic and it's partly nurture. So the two must interact for a healthy brain. So genes will only go so far, nurture will only go so far. So the genes effectively get modified by nurture, and that includes culture. So that red system, what I really don't want to do is to say to people, this is how your red brain works. What I try and remember is always to say, you're unique, you may not resonate with this. So some people are not risk aversive, they're actually risk takers, and they love that, you know? But they may be taking risk where it's safe risk. So relatively, nothing safe, even crossing the road. But if you go on, say, a bungee jump, most of us probably would be very apprehensive because it's a risk. But actually, it's not a big risk if it's been done properly. So your brain works out, and all of us are genetically prone to certain risks, and then we learn how to take risks. So that red system we all have it, but it's unique to you. Which is why I'm saying at the beginning of this interview, when I sit with someone, I need to help them explore, what is your system like? What I'm not going to do is tell them. But what does help is if we know that for the vast majority of us, myself included, the red system for me always overreacts. You know, if something goes wrong and it's catastrophic, it's the end of the world straight away. So we learn that isn't us. That's nothing to do with us. That's a system which is inbuilt, and it will run regardless of what you do. So it will work that way. So that's the first system. What I then looked at in the 90s is a secondary system came into play. And this system is very, very slow to move. And it's under the power of the red system. So I'm going to call it the blue system. The blue system is voluntary control from us. We actually actively use that to think and decide on what we want. And this is where we see that system contains values. It also holds perspective, which the red system can't do. Therefore, the blue system doesn't overreact. And the blue system works by looking at facts, information. It's rational. It works out consequences. It looks at logic. This system is effectively is us because we have control of that in our own head, whereas we do not have control of the red system. And the red system has the ability to freeze us. So the red system actually controls us. There are no control mechanisms going back the other way.
And yet the blue system, you would say, is us.
Yes.
What is that? Is that our genetics? Is that our culture and our nurture? Is that all of those things put together?
It's partly that, but what the difference is the red system is almost unconsciously working without our say-so. So it makes decisions for us based around what its needs are, which is to keep us to survive. The blue system is where we make decisions which can override that. So let me try and give a simple example. I usually use food because most people relate to it. The blue system is rationality, in fact. So we all know how much to eat and we all know what to eat. So if we set off and we said, right, we're going to decide this today, I'm going to eat healthily and sensible quantities. And the vast majority is fine. By the end of the day, we didn't stick to that. So we have to ask why we didn't stick to it. And if we look and scan in real terms, what is actually happening in the brain, what we're finding is that this red system is freezing us out and then working impulsively without thought for consequence, which is what it does, because it wants survival, but it's also very impetuous in most people, and it's impulsive, so it wants immediate gratification.
And can that be the self-destructive part of the brain then as well?
Well, I don't see it as self-destructive. It's a system. It's nothing to do with you, so it's not self-destructive. It may be destructive in its approach, but it's a system. The way the best to see it is you're living in your head as the blue system, that is you, and then suddenly you get this bolted onto you, this entire red system that is trying to help you, but actually can do a lot of damage and can attack you because it worries, it gets overreactive and so on. So what I'm saying is recognise you have a machine here which is powerful, and if you get it on side, it's the best friend you'll have. But if you don't get it on side, it will start attacking you.
So, for example, I'm a natural worrier. That's something I remember being...
Well, if we stop, yeah, this is good. You can't worry. This is really important. Neuroscientifically, you can't worry.
Okay, explain.
Is, if you said to me, I am a natural worrier, what you're really saying is I want to be that, which you clearly you don't. Otherwise,
no.
You wouldn't have brought it up, right? So what you're saying to me...
I feel like this is going to be a private therapy session.
Right, public analysis, right. So, but this is what I'm trying to say. The light bulb moment has to come is, if I asked you, what would you like to be? You won't say a natural word. You'll start to just be calm and collected and enjoy my life. So if I were able, I can't, to amputate all the bits of the brain that are nothing under your control, you will present to the world a calm and collected picture. Because that is you. You've just told me who you are. And that's what you present. The problem that you've got, along with all of us, is we now most necessarily attach this survival mechanism. So the red brain now gets attached. And what you've now said to me is this. I am a natural, calm and collected person. My red system that's been attached onto me overpowers me, hijacks me, and presents to the world a very different picture. And it's not what I am. It's not who I am. It's what it does trying to protect me. So the problem I have is not I'm a natural warrior. That's not accurate scientifically. The problem is this. I'm a calm, collected person. There's a mismatch between me and the red system. And the red system has the ability to hijack me. So the problem is I don't know how to manage it. That's a very different problem.
So is the red system... I mean, I'm thinking, if it's got nothing to do with me and I can control it and learn to control it, if I understand
you
correctly.
You can manage it, you can't control it.
Okay.
We're coming to the management.
Okay. But it makes me think that divorces me from responsibility for that, for that red system. And I think that might be an easy way out.
Let me help you. This is not a let-out model. What I'm saying is that if you had a pet dog, you're 100% responsible. You're not the dog, but it's part of you in the sense that you and the dog are this couple that come into the room. But you're 100% responsible for training that dog and keeping it on a lead. So if the dog runs across and bites me, you can't just hold your hands and say, it was just my dog. Absolutely not. So there is no excuse on this. I'm quite harsh on people. You're 100% responsible for training this chimp and managing it. 100%.
But you've no say over with the nature of your chimp then.
Brilliant. you've done well.
I mean, I could pass the test
that
at school.
That was a light bulb moment. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. And the reason I brought this in is when it dawned on me in the 90s, looking at this on the research and the scanners and meeting people and recognising this, it's a relief to know that now you know what the problem is. It's not you. You're not the problem. The problem is your ability to manage, recognise and manage this system. You can't be responsible for the nature of the system because you didn't choose it. Much as you didn't choose the colour of your eyes, the colour of your hair, your height, you were given them. There's no point complaining. Mm-hmm. You've got to assess what you've got, right? And then what you say is, let me make the most of that. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Emotionally, we're given these machines which are variable, but most of them are not that helpful unless we learn to train and manage them. So our emotions are brilliant machines, but you're not responsible for the nature of the machine, but you are responsible to manage it.
So how did that apply then practically to sport? And you say, quite rightly, Sir Chris Hoy, Victoria Pendleton, they've been very open about their work with you. And I'm not obviously asking you to say anything that they wouldn't have said. But how then did that work in practice for them and allow them then to win medals?
I think what I'm trying to do is to say, let's get you some insight into what you're dealing with first. So like we've just done here, which is a bit of fun, but you can see the serious side that if you suddenly perceive, actually, there's me, which is what I call the human, is the blue circus, the human being, and I'm getting on with my life. But like all the other hominids, we all share this red brain. It's very similar, very similar, which means that's why we see so many activities chimpanzees do, which are similar to us, especially when they're frustrated or affectionate. And this is that part of the brain, which is part of us, just as the colour of your eyes are part of you. You know, your chimp brain is part of you, but it's a part that has its own life. So what I'm saying is that if you then recognise this, there's me as a human, and then there's the red or chimp system, which is a thinking, active part of my brain, I need to manage that, then you then have a better self-esteem. Because otherwise, what you did a minute ago, which is what I get, is I'm a worrier. And I'm thinking, well, that's not true. That's not accurate. And what you've now done, if you think about this, and I'm jumping a bit to try and help, is you've come to a conclusion that you're someone with really quite low self-esteem. You're not going into a room thinking, I'm really proud of who I am. You're coming in almost excusing yourself and saying, I'm so sorry. I'm just this crazy neurotic person who worries for. And I'm thinking, well,
it's easier to do that and get it out of the way so that nobody else can voice that upon you, isn't it?
But the reality is, if you actually went in the room and thought, I'm this really great person who's calm and collected, because you are, but I do have this machine, which, you know, I may have to apologise for at times, and I'm going to need to be responsible for, but I'm going to start working with that to see, how do I work that machine to my advantage? So let's take cycling or any sport. And it doesn't matter who I work with. I work with corporate people, I work with hospital doctors, I work with students, I work with your public. All I say to them is, what are you trying to achieve? So let's take an Olympic cyclist. Let's go back to the days of the velodrome. And when I worked there, let's say then one of them says to me, right, I want to, whatever, ride around four times in a circle. All right? That's what I'm going to do.
I love how you reduce elite sport to that. Yes. Brilliant.
But that's what I want to do. Right. So I say, okay, it doesn't matter what you ask me. I'm going to see, is it reasonable, first of all? Can you do that? Okay. And why can't you just go ahead and do what you want to do? And then they will say to me what you've just said. They say, this part of my brain, I'm interpreting for them, this chimp brain is coming in with ridiculous beliefs. Like, if it's a really important competition, then I'm freezing. I'm terrified to get on the bike in case I get it wrong. So what the chimp brain does, which it's got to do, is, remember, it's looking for danger. I've got to look at the consequence. If I don't get this right in the next few minutes, it's going to be 4 years before I see it again. And also it's going to have massive repercussions on my life, which it will. Absolutely. I'm not saying it won't. But is that what you want to be getting on a bike thinking? And most people say, well, not really. That's not going to help me. And I ask, what do you want to think? That's the key. I don't know. What do you want to think? And clearly in most sports, I just want to think about the process. I don't want to think of consequence. I want to deal with consequence. The third system now comes in, and this is the critical one.
So, you still with us so far? I told you it was worth the effort. Well, have a listen to the next episode of When Orla Met Dr. Steve Peters to learn about the third and critical part of our brain and how we program it to get us into what is commonly known as the flow, or how we simply manage those moments of panic or neurosis that threaten to derail a whole day, a project, or just our mood.
There aren't circuits that control our emotions. There aren't any. If there were, then if we got frightened, we'd just stop. We'd just say, right, I don't want to do that. But it's not the way it works. Or if we're waking up in the night worried about something, we'd just say, oh, I'm going to stop now. But there aren't circuits to do that, which is why it's frustrating for us. So we get attacked again by this chimp that's still eating too much, still not exercising, still getting worried before a competition, or still waking up in the night and worrying. So the answer is then, how do we manage it? If we can't control it, how do you manage it to limit the damage or get it on board?
That's coming up in the next episode of When Orla Met, available to download on all your usual podcast platforms right now. A huge thanks as ever to Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode of When Orla Met. And don't forget, you can subscribe entirely for free to the podcast for all the previous episodes and to make sure you don't miss any of the chats still to come. And if you fancy, do leave me a review on iTunes. It does actually make a difference. And let me know what you think. I love getting your feedback and ideas for upcoming episodes. Get in touch on Twitter or Instagram at WhenOrlaMet.